Dave's psychology lectures are part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network. So, sorry about class, especially those of you that were, of course, going to come in early on Friday and such, and turned out I wasn't able to come. If you looked on the website, you can see why. I had to change a tire in our car, or on our car, not in it. They don't have tires inside the car. Made me feel very manly. That was good, very masculine. I can say we did an okay job. We had to buy a new tire. I will say that no one's going to be calling Isabel and I to work for Ferrari next year in the pits on the Grand Prix circuit, but we did get the tire changed. So there it is. So sorry about that. Like I said, just such is life. These things happen. For those of you that didn't come, you can all pretend, like, oh, yeah, I was there early and I saw the sign. So that's good for you. For those of you that were here and that you're pissed off at me for making you wake up, it's not my fault. I don't schedule the classes. Blame Dave Marasco. Today we're going to talk about, we'll finish up the stuff on brain organization as far as the neuroanatomy goes. Then we'll get a bit into a little bit of neurophysiology, especially as far as the cells go and how they communicate and how they work. Much of this you likely know, though likely not in the kind of detail we'll talk about today. We were just about to talk about the forebrain, so why don't we? Now we're starting to get into where those lobes are. Now I realize you could divide it up into, but basically the hemispheres, you know, we started talking about there's two sides, the left and the right. Collectively, this area is known as the cortex. We're going to have some old cortex and some neocortex or new cortex. The old cortex is the limbic system of the limbic cortex. This is below that, the neocortex. The neocortex, of course, is the wrinkly bits, right? So you got your temporal lobe, you got your parietal and frontal and occipital lobe divided into two hemispheres. Below that, you've got this, people call it old cortex. It's called that because it's something that actually shows up in animals besides us. And presumably then it's a little older. It's more primitive, but primitive in evolutionary biology sense just means older, okay? You'll see basically a limbic system in pretty much all animals. A lot of them, you don't see a whole hell of a lot of cortex though, whereas we've got a lot of neocortex, we've got that. At the base of the cortex, you've got the basal ganglia. Ganglia means bunches of neurons. Basal means at the base of. It's pretty easy, isn't it? This is important, and we'll get way into what all these things do at some point in the course. But right now, for our purposes, you can just think of it as being important in movement. This is especially important in smooth movement. We talked about cerebellum being important there, too. The substantia nigra is there. This is a dopaminergic, so it runs on dopamine, part of the brain. That basically, if you don't have enough dopamine in substantia nigra and it's down to a really low level, you've got Parkinson's disease. Okay? And Parkinson's disease, of course, you get tremors, and some people actually get to the point where they're completely immobile. What then eventually happens, of course, is we treat this now with, you might think, well, if you don't have enough dopamine, treat it with dopamine. Well, of course, we can't just treat it with dopamine. Because dopamine doesn't get into the brain directly. You'd have to actually directly inject it into the brain. And that involves drilling holes in people's heads, and we're not quite into that. So what you do is you give people a precursor of dopamine called L-DOPA. And that's spelled L-DOPA, not L-DOPA, like the name of some matador, like E-L, And I mention that because that's how I spelled it in my notes when I was in a class like this in 1986. And then I wrote it on a test and felt like a real idiot when the TA circled it and said, it's not the name of a matador, it's a chemical. And of course, that was discovered by Robin Williams in the film Awakening. So that's basal ganglia. We're going to get up now to the limbic system. We got, I say HP there, no, not the steak sauce, but the hippocampus. Trivia, a little bit of trivia. HP on the HP sauce stands for Houses of Parliament. Did you know that? I'm serious, it does. You can see the British Parliament on HP steak sauce. See, now you've learned something today. If you can take home anything today, it's that I know all kinds of useless crap. That's what I have the extra brain for. That's why I have a giant head. I think I've told many of you that I have the... People say I'm a big head, and I say, wait a second. When I played high school football, we had a guy on our team called Big Head, and I had the second biggest helmet after him. So he was short, though. He had a giant head. He looked like those guys, you know, like at Mardi Gras, like in New Orleans, and people walking around with big heads on. He looked like that. Then we got the nucleus accumbens. It's down there. The accumbens, and I talked about this previously, is important in feeling good, in reward. It runs also on dopamine. And the thing about the accumbens, there's a circuit, the accumbens, the medial forebrain bundle, etc. And we'll talk about that. We talk about how drugs work. But basically what the accumbens does is it makes you feel good. So this area is operated when you feel good. Anything feels good. When you laugh, when you are enjoying yourself in any way. And that can be anything from taking heroin to having an orgasm to watching Family Guy. Or what is quickly becoming my new favorite movie, Team America, World Police. That is awesome. If you get a chance, rent or buy it. Don't steal it off the internet. You got the olfactory bulb down there. So I'm just picking some areas here, okay? Oh, I forgot to talk about amygdala. Amygdala is emotion. I got a question mark there because it's interesting. The story goes, and I'm not sure if this is true, but it's sort of an apocryphal story. People didn't know where emotion happened in the brain, and people didn't know what the amygdala did, so they said, I bet it does emotion. one of those things. Now, it probably does have a lot to do with very intense emotions, things like fear, surprise, anger, those type things. And you can see that what we have here is we got an area that's going to be important for learning with all this put together, including probably the olfactory bulb. Ours is pretty small, of course, because we don't care much about smelling. We're more into seeing. Think about this thing. A hippocampus, which we know from is important for memory in a lot of different species. We've got amygdala, which is important for emotion. Think about this from an adaptive point of view. You would want a circuit that would somehow connect hippocampus and amygdala, because things that are emotionally really powerful should be remembered, shouldn't they? Things that are either awesome or horrible should be really well remembered. Right? I mean, that's the function of learning is to predict the future. And the best prediction of the future is what happened in the past, right? So if it's like, I went here and got chased by a saber-toothed tiger and that was scary, you should remember that. That's an important thing to remember. And of course, the accumbens, on the other hand, you've got something there that basically makes sense to be hooked up here, because that's where reward is. It's the reward system. It's the reward system in the brain. So if you've got the reward system there and memory, emotion, makes sense. This is all going to be sort of in the same area, right? I mentioned the olfactory bulb. As I said, ours is quite small which makes a lot of sense, because why waste neural tissue on something we're not very good at? We're better at smell than we think we are. We can detect about one, with chemicals that we can detect with that chemical sense, smell, we can detect about one part per 10 billion in the air. That's pretty impressive. That's pretty impressive when you think about it. It's also kind of gross when you think about it, because really when you smell like farts, that means there's actual farts in your nose, which is kind of gross, right? Fart molecules. Or we walk, go drive by that sewage treatment plant where they make farts. That's where they're built for the whole city. Is it awful? Anybody else live in the East End? Yeah. Oh, is it bad, eh, right now? They better get that bad boy fixed. That's all I got to say, because when you go, I'll take the garbage out, at least that stench will get rid of the smell of crap in my, you know, over me. Anyway, the olfactory bulb in other animals, especially nocturnal animals, much bigger than ours, like per divided by brain size, body weight, etc. Like in animals, a lot of nocturnal birds compared to diurnal birds. Diurnal just means you're awake during the day, nocturnal at night, much bigger. Not surprising. They have to navigate somehow. You know, and you don't see a lot of owls that have developed night vision goggles. Now, so that's the cranial nervous system. We already talked about the different lobes, the parietal, temporal, etc. Then there's the spinal nervous system. You got the spinal column back here, and this is actually quite a neat, nice diagram. You got nerves running to and from the spinal column that control the body and receive input. So we have different areas of our spinal column, okay, different sections, and they receive input and control different parts of the body. Okay, so we call those dermatomes, these areas in the skin. Okay, so for example, if you have, I'm pointing this guy's ass. If you have, let's go up here. That's up around C2, right? So if this is how, for example, anybody here ever had a pinched nerve? Anybody? Because I've had that. Okay. Yeah. And you find out that like one part of your body goes numb. Yeah. And also you have trouble, so you, when it's numb, you can't feel input. You also can't get any output. And what happens when you go to the doctor? They say it's something in your spine, and you go, no, you didn't hear me. It's not my spine. It turns out that it's right around here, you know, right below my belly button. They say, no, that's your spine, because you see, let's see, and that's what? Where are we on there? So that'd be right about here, because they know that part of your body is controlled by this part of your spine, input and output. And you get some weird things, too, where you can have, like, look at here, for example. This is S4, outside of your calf, and the back of your calf, right, is way down here, sciatic nerve, right? You always hear about sciatica? Pretty cool. So they can. This is how a neurologist, without having to, you know, rip you open and look at your spine, can just take just look at where you hurt and where you, like, where you feel pain. They use maybe often a little tiny little pin, you know, or something like that to see if you detect it. And if you can't, and it's going to map like that onto your body. And it's not like everybody's is different. We're all built the same on this. Okay? I think there's one. Oh, there isn't one more point, because I wanted to make one more point. Now, this is if there's a little pinch, it's going to block off one area, and then you understand that, right? Now, look, think of what would happen if the area from your spine, say from here, that controls just above, like the small of your back, up, gets severed. You see why you'd be paralyzed from here down, because the information can't get out or in. Then you see why if you get like what Christopher Reeve had, which basically was right about C3 or C4, all you can control is your face, and that's it, nothing else. So that's why you would become, in that case, a quadriplegic, you see? So it's pretty, excuse me, it's pretty straightforward actually how this works. And this is why we can use these dermatomes, as they're called, to determine where someone has an injury. Okay? Any questions on that? It makes a great definition question, by the way, on tests. Dermatome. Define and demonstrate the significance of. So everybody suddenly starts taking notes. Does that make sense? Okay, so it's pretty straightforward, actually. And maybe you wondered if you ever did have a pinched nerve, why a nerve on your back could make the outside of your calf be numb. Well, there you go. Because all the input and output from your brain to your body goes through your spinal column. All of it. And this is why, again, if you break your back and sever your parts of your spinal column, you'll be paralyzed. And, of course, the sad thing here is it's part of the, not only the spinal nervous system, but when we use the other nomenclature, part of the central nervous system, those neurons don't regrow. If we could get them to regrow, people would get in accidents and it would just repair itself and you'd be fine. All right, so let's get inside the spinal column. We got the dorsal root. Now the dorsal, it's the back. Top part, towards your back. Okay, this is actually sort of a cutaway. I wish this projector was a bit better. So this is from the sensory receptors, and these are for touch, basically. But of course, also heat and cold and pain. Dorsal root, you see, so it's towards the back. That's going to be from that area. And the ventral root towards your gut, that's going to be for controlling. That's going to be to motor neurons. But the dermatome that each thing is hooked up to, it's the same for both sensation and for movement. So for sensory and motor neurons. This is called the Bell-Magendie law, because it works that way in everything. Everything in the spinal column works like this. So we can give it, these two guys said, well, we should call it a law. And one guy was Bell, and the other one was Magendie. So I wonder if they flipped a coin to see who goes first. They said, let's do it alphabetically. I don't know. Maybe arm wrestling. They could have arm wrestled for it. Rock, paper, scissors. Closest to the wall with a hockey card. There's a lot of possibilities here. That's another one of them great definition questions. Bell-Magendie law. Define and demonstrate the significance of. Draw me that picture. You tell me what the law is, that the dorsal root is always for sensation. The ventral root's always for movement. Might want to throw in something about a dermatome in there. Got yourself a good mark on that question. All right. Any questions about that? All right. We can also talk about the internal, which I hate that name, or autonomic system. I like that one a bit better because I'm sort of more used to it. We get the sympathetic system, and I think I talked about this, and that's for arousal. And the parasympathetic system, that's the cool down system, basically. Okay, so we got one system that it's the fight or flight response, right? And we got another system that is the digest food and sleep system. A lot of what's going on here is hormonal. So it's not so much done with neurotransmitters. It's basically done with hormones. Now, a lot of neurotransmitters are also hormones. Epinephrine or adrenaline it's the same molecule used as a neurotransmitter as it also acts as a hormone. When it gets into the bloodstream and affects organs, we call that a hormone. When its action is neuron to neuron or neuron to muscle, we call that a neurotransmitter. But there's a lot of things that are both. There's a lot of things that are both. So if one's working, sympathetic, parasympathetic shuts down because they do the opposite thing, right? So what happens there is the parasympathetic system, this is for the fight or flight response, so you are being chased by a saber-toothed tiger, or what else could it be? I can't find a parking spot, or you just get in an accident, or a near miss, right? It's like your body is basically adapted to say, let's not worry about fighting off infection or digesting our food because we might be non-existent shortly. Let's run. Your reaction times decrease, which means you're faster. Doesn't mean you're slower. Reaction time decrease means you're faster. I've had a lot of people misunderstand that for some reason. What else happens? You stop worrying about fighting off infection. You start getting sugar pumped to your muscles so you can run fast. Heart beats faster, you sweat, pupils dilate, all these good things. But it's not instantaneous, is it? Anybody here ever have a near miss driving? Like somebody just almost cuts you off or like almost kills you? Anybody have one of those? Yeah, I've been in a car like that anyway, I don't drive. I'd be having them all the time if the blind guy was driving. I'd be in a constant state of sympathetic arousal. What happens is, what's always the case though? When you do avoid the accident, it's like, wow, I did that. And then about 45 seconds later, your heart starts going, dung, 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 dung. And you can almost taste like a tinny taste of adrenaline in your mouth. Your mouth gets all dry. It's horrible. It's like, well, where was that when I needed it? Well, again, normally the kind of things that we were fighting, first of all, the system has to work through hormones, so it's not going to be instantaneous. Secondly, most of the things that we dealt with back in the EEA, which is where we evolved, the environment of evolutionary adaptation, okay, so early on, like the plains of Africa, threats were ran for more than 45 seconds. Right? It's like, there's the tiger, better run. It's not like, oh, I had a near miss with the saber-toothed tiger, it's fine now. that wasn't the way it worked, right? So, but nowadays, a lot of these stress reactions we have, and this is basically your stress reaction, can be anything. This is like, I don't know about you guys, I hate opening my PUC bill. And when I see the PUC bill, about 45 seconds later, I hear a boom, 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 because it's like, I wonder how much money electricity costs this month. Because it keeps going up. I think maybe I'm going to start just perhaps have the children run on little treadmills. I think that might work, something to that effect. Just hold out an Xbox controller in front of them, going, no, you'll get it soon, keep running. Actually, it would work with me. It's my Xbox. So this is a hormonal system, it's a little bit different, but it's still part of the nervous system. Okay, now, we're going to wrap this up with what we call principles of nervous system organization. And these follow for us, but also for, most of these are for any vertebrate, all of these are for any vertebrate. Most of these will apply to anything with a nervous system. So also a bee or a slug or a little flatworm. All right. The sequence of events tends to be input, so that the information comes in, and then you integrate the information with other information. This could be from already in your brain. So visual let's think of a quick example with humans. Visual information comes in, words like that up there. Your brain figures out what the pattern is. You don't know this is happening, of course. And then it's integrated with other information, like your ability to read and know the meanings of words and such. And then you get output. Many of you, of course, as you can see what the output is right now, you're writing stuff down, or you may be talking to yourself thinking, oh, yeah, I understand that, what have you. There's a functional division between sensory and motor systems. We already talked about the dorsal and ventral roots. This is also true up in the brain. I should change hands here. I got so much stuff I'm turning around today. I don't trust this putting this thing in my pocket anymore. So I'm holding it, but I got the mouse here and this thing here. Inputs and outputs are crossed. Right? So they go through a similar area. They cross over top of each other. You get both symmetry. I love this one. Here's a principle. It's symmetric and not. So it's symmetrical and asymmetrical. In other words, we can think of you have a left hippocampus and a right hippocampus, a left temporal lobe and a right temporal lobe. That's great. Also, however, you have in your left part of your brain, you have Broca's and Wernicke's areas, and they aren't in your right part of your brain. The right part of your brain is doing, as a rule, a lot more stuff with spatial information. It's doing a lot more stuff with mathematical stuff. Left part of your brain is doing language. That is a vast oversimplification. But that's asymmetrical, isn't it? Basically, the nervous system can be thought of as doing two things, excitation and inhibition. Turning things on and turning them off. Some circuits turn things on, some circuits turn things off. Some neurons in a circuit make it more likely to make a cell fire. Some make it less likely for a cell to fire. So we have and again, this happens in any nervous system. We have multiple levels of function. What does that mean? It just means basically that you have, let's draw a picture here maybe. I don't want to put that down. Be careful with it so don't click it. OK, multiple levels of function. So down at the bottom, let's say you're talking about vision. Vision's a good example. So you got the input, and this would be in the retina, and it's doing just raw information. And then it goes up to the optic nerve. And then it goes up, and there's a whole lot of other steps here, but into V1 through V5 of occipital lobe. and then it goes back out and it gets analyzed, and then you have action. Okay? So you have multiple levels of function. But basically, you can see here, for example, if you knocked out the optic nerve, your eyes would still work, they just wouldn't have anywhere to go. If we knocked out part of visual cortex, and we talked about this the other day, part of your occipital lobe, you might say, let's say you have a lesion in V1, you might end up not seeing anything subjectively, like you can't report seeing anything, yet you can kind of still see, you'd have blind sight. And this is all being done in parallel, so stuff's all happening at once, but it's also hierarchical. Hierarchical meaning, as you can see here, one thing above another. Right? That's a hierarchy. But it's got to be done in parallel. Think about your visual system for a second. If you have 130 million receptors per eye, so we have 130 megapixel eyes, for those of you that are into digital cameras. If we had to analyze the input of each of those cells individually, it would take a freaking long time to recognize anything now, wouldn't it? So we analyze the input of all of each of your receptors at the same time. So it's done in parallel. And that's called the Hewlings-Jackson law, or principle. And that's actually one guy. He had a hyphenated name. It's Hewlings-Jackson. It's a very English name, isn't it? Hewlings-Jackson. Yes, of course. It's parallel and hierarchical. Of course, he spoke just like Winston Churchill. Never have so many neurons, done so much, or so many. We shall fight them on the beaches. Okay, that's enough of my Winston Churchill impression. We shall never surrender. Apparently it wasn't enough. Okay. We got localization. There's a lot of freaking paradoxes here that pisses me off, but that's life. It's because these are all true. We got localization and distribution. In other words, we have localized control and function, but also distributed function. Okay, so let's think about, let's go back to vision. Localized in occipital lobe. No one ever challenges the idea that vision's being done in your occipital lobe. So that's true. But the analysis of the stuff is being done not only in occipital lobe, you have analysis being done of visual information all over your brain. Except basically, well, I mean, temporal lobe isn't doing raw analysis of visual data, but it's integrating visual data, so it's still doing it. This is something that should point you to tell people that when they say we only use 10% of our brain, to ask them what 90% they'd like removed. Because people, when they think, oh yeah, well, when you do X, you only use this part of your brain, they see your other part's not like lit up as much, and they think you're not using it. You're using it all the freaking time. Sometimes different cells are firing, sometimes others aren't. But you can't go around saying, I don't know, how many people, first of all, how many people have heard this? We only use 10% of our brain. I'm just curious. Okay, good, so everybody pretty much. How many people were taught this by someone? Oh, dear God. Okay, that's pretty pathetic. It's not true. It's just a complete, utter lie. It's up there with, there's an evolutionary ladder with angel, first it's God, then angels, then humans. It's up there with left-brained and right-brained. And people learn that in school. Oh, what's happened? Give me the names of your teachers after class, because I got to go kick some ass. see, thing is, that whole I mentioned before, we got symmetry and asymmetry, so we have left and right functions. We do. The left side of my body is controlled by the right half of my brain. I will not deny that. The left side of my brain is doing much more linguistic functioning, apparently not very well, than the right side of my brain. The right side's doing more spatial, mathematical, that kind of thing. But this notion that you have a dominant hemisphere and that makes you creative or not. Look, I shouldn't teach poetry. For a lot of reasons, I'm never going to regale you with my excellent poetry, but me words together put, rhyme not good, okay? But people that don't know anything about neurology or psychology shouldn't be teaching you anything. What's out of your brain to use? It seems that comes up. I'm not trashing people that teach English, and I certainly don't mean here. But it seems to me a lot of times these are art people that say that. Use the left half of your brain. Oh, shut up. Why don't you let me teach you how to paint? Because I can't do that. People read like half of a newspaper article and think they're freaking neuroscientists. It's like, I don't know anything about art. And I don't get art. And then I have to have it explained to me and I feel stupid, in the words of George Costanza. Point is, that whole we will talk about asymmetry, and it's great stuff, and some of it's fascinating, about the fact that we basically, in a lot of respects, have two minds in one. You know, people, split brain patients, corpus callosum severed, amazing data, interesting stuff, tells us a lot about symmetry and asymmetry. But you got to realize that when someone makes a grand statement like you're left-brained or right-brained, ask them, if they're left-brained, if you could remove the right half, if they'd be okay with that then. No, I saw that on the Discovery Channel, or no, I think it was the Learning Channel, right after a show about psychics, so it must be true. These also make great, this is another fine test question, by the way. What are the principles of nervous system organization? Give me 7. And make up an example. It's a good question. Again, now everybody quickly writes them down. But these are pretty good. And of course, when I would say give me an example, all I need is something very basic. I don't need wiring diagrams like that. That is the human visual system. And that's the simple version. Okay? That's the easy. Don't worry. I'm not going to ask you this. I couldn't reproduce it either. I don't expect you to reproduce anything I can't. But look at this. Now, this actually, though, demonstrates a lot of the... There's a couple reasons I'm showing you this. One is that to show you this stuff's way hard, so you should feel smart because you're in here. Two is to show you that a lot of these principles are true. Now, we can't see asymmetry and asymmetry, but we can certainly see things like parallel and hierarchical functioning. Look, parallel, because look at all the things that are happening at once. Bang, bang, bang. That's all the same level. It's a hierarchy. Yet, it's parallel, but it is a hierarchy. You can see that. Look at this. Isn't that amazing? This blows my mind. So you don't have to draw the diagram. Don't worry. There's always one guy. Could you go back to that? I want to draw it. No. Download it. But it's like, look, we got, actually, I mean, the diagram that I've seen that's a little more complete has about, I got to remember the numbers here, it's something like 120 subsystems. And I mean, the people that discover these things can't draw them from memory, believe me. Okay? So I wouldn't expect you to do it. All right. Any questions about this stuff before we move on to talk about some cells? All right. So let's talk about cells. Okay, so I can close this. Slideshow view show. All right, this is also called brain organization. This is about cells. Is this one on, has anybody checked? Is this one on the net yet? Did I put the link up? Yeah, okay. Oh yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff on there, isn't there? Yeah, okay, that's true. That'll get us about to November, actually, perhaps. Okay, we touched a little bit on neurons and glial cells when I say last time. This was supposed to be done. But we went a little slow, but that's okay. I want you to, you know, I don't want to go too fast. Okay, now we're going to go into detail. So we're going to talk about different kinds of neurons, different kinds of glial cells. Neurons are the information processing unit of the nervous system. Excuse me. This is cool. It may in fact be the case that single neurons can control behavior and single neurons can store information. Now, it doesn't mean that everything's controlled by single neurons, and all information is stored that way. In fact, I would think even people that are way into this sort of single neuron hypothesis would tell you that was crazy. But it's certainly possible. Now that we know about DNA and protein expression and stuff like that, it may be that like a pattern of protein expression and gene expression and protein densities and stuff in a cell may have code for different types of information. It's really incredible. If you want to know more, by the way, about this whole protein, about how DNA works, there's a great podcast you should listen to called Futures in Biotech. It gets really technical, but it's for somebody with a brain but isn't a scientist. The guy who hosts it's a scientist, but the other guy who hosts it is just some guy who doesn't have a biology degree or anything. So it's Futures in Biotech. It's really quite cool. In the most recent episode, they talked about how gene expression works. So if you're interested in that and you've got all kinds of free time like so many students do, you might want to check that out. I'll put a link on the blog page under the technology podcast section, okay? So you can check it out. It's more common that networks of neurons do this. So instead of having information stored in a single neuron, you would have information stored in a network. How would this work? Well, you have a pattern then of activation of a set of neurons, and that pattern would mean, now I'm going to, again, vastly oversimplify. That pattern means, looking around, yellow shirt. I picked you because you're sitting right there. Okay? Or that pattern means someone left a thing on and I had to go to the library and go get a key that's, and we started 6 minutes late. Because I'm so right-brained. I'm only using 10% of my brain anyway. So it's more likely a pattern of activation most of the time. But it doesn't mean that we can dismiss the notion of single neurons storing information. All right. And this is going to be done with neurons, not glial cells. Neurons are doing the information processing. Glial cells do the support stuff. This is a diagram that if you've taken a few classes with me, this is my favorite neuron diagram, so you've seen it before likely. This looks much better than the one I usually draw on the board that usually ends up looking like a moose. When I draw a neuron, it almost always looks like this. And it looks like some really weird looking sort of cartoony moose. See? Doesn't it? Except that it's only got one eye, because that's the nucleus. Looks like some sort of Chernobyl moose, you know? So, Chernobyl was a nuclear disaster, former Soviet Union, 1986. Just getting you up to speed on that. Okay. The dendrites, look, the arrows are saying which way the information's going. That's nice. So we got the arrows coming in. That's the information coming in from the dendrites. There's a cell nucleus. You have to know a whole lot more parts. There's a couple others, and we'll talk about them shortly. This is the axon. Information keeps going, keeps going. And then we got these little terminals here, you see? And we're going to the next neuron. So you can have, and the typical thing we learn about an intro, which is fine, is that the axon has one end, and that synapses to the next neuron. And it's not quite that simple as you can see there because they got these little fingers, teleodendria. All right. Here we have, this has got a myelin sheath on the axon, you see that? Myelin sheath looks like sort of sausages or something. Freud would like that. Sometimes an axon is just an axon. That is a limited audience joke. That is a narrow crowd. And then in between here, you see how it's not, the myelin sheath doesn't totally cover it. Like, you think of it as like insulation for a wire, like your cable TV. I love the analogies. Think of it as like cable TV. And it's, you know how like you ever play with the cable and you strip the cable and then you put a new one and as soon as the guy leaves, you put cable up to 27 different things in your house and you're paying for one? Yeah, we've all done that, haven't we? Inside the insulation, there's wire. So we tend to think that this stuff being sort of like insulation, I only got wire, but why would there be gaps? Well, we'll talk about that shortly, and I think most of you know, but that those gaps are called nodes of Ranvier, R-A-N-V-I-E-R. Or if you're from the States or Alberta, Ranvier. It's a joke. I kid because I love. I made sure about that. I looked that up, make sure it was a French guy, because maybe it was Ranvier, and I've been making that joke for years, but I'm pretty sure it's not Ranvier. All right, so that's a pretty decent drawing of a neuron. Okay, here's some amazing neuron facts. You can impress your friends, fly for the party with. These are great icebreakers, by the way. Great way to pick up girls, guys, just letting you know. You tell them some stuff about neurons, and then when they walk away with a look of bemused resignation, this is why I was never very successful with the ladies. Hey, baby, you know you were born with all the neurons you're ever going to have. Doesn't chicks don't dig that. I've found, over the years, learned that. Yeah, you're born with them all. You got more, babies got more neurons than you do. Of course, you're going to ask them, why are babies so stupid? Well, because they aren't hooked up yet. I can throw 800 circuit boards at you, but it's not a computer. You could say, I got more circuit boards than you, but that's not going to help you. Neurons change with experience. And the changes happen, a lot of these things are about, again, I was talking about gene expression. They're about things like that. Or they can move, like they grow and change, move. You know, like an axon might go over and synapse to something else. Ooh, if they don't make connections, they die. Well, think about that's very sensible. Think about we didn't talk about it. It was another class. It was in the same room. It gets all so confusing over the years. I don't even know where I am. They got to make connections. If they don't make connections, they die. Taking a neuron, I sounded very sad there, didn't I? They die. Save the neurons. And if you act now, please, to our telethon to save neurons. Wait a second, let's go to the tote board. Ed McMahon comes on. I love this man, and I mean that. You ever watch those telethons? It's all just maudlin, right? With Jerry Lewis. It's awesome. Anyway, these are expensive units to maintain, these neurons. Using lots of most of your resources. Your sugar, your oxygen is being used up by freaking neurons. If they aren't working, kill them. They're just wasting. No, but really think about it. They're just wasting time. They're wasting energy. Why maintain something that's not doing anything? So if they don't make a connection, they die. There's actually programmed cell death in a neuron. Neurons are like, if no connection, I die. Like a little suicide pact. And I blame it all on heavy metal music and video games. You can grow new ones in the central nervous system. We found this out recently, the last 15 years or so. So you can grow new neurons. This is sort of going to be the basis eventually of treatments for things like spinal injuries and stuff. So it's not that you can never grow new ones. One of the neat things that happens, and I was talking about how they change with experience, the genetic blueprint, in other words, the DNA, basically, in a lot of respects, can get sort of reopened. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that the way genes work involves one gene turning on another gene and turning on another. An environmental input is always doing it at the same time, saying, no, you turn off, you turn on, you turn off, you turn on. So you're constantly getting changes in the internal state, like in the nucleus, of not the genome itself. Right, not the genome itself. It can't change. Well, it can change bad copies, etc. But what it's the protein expression, the gene expression with proteins can change and sort of reopen what's happening. We used to think that they were static things, that all they were doing, the genes were doing, was coding for neurotransmitters and maybe microtubules, things like that. That's not all they're doing. because that the expression of genes via proteins may be what's involved in like single neuron information storage, which is pretty damn cool, like really damn cool. So this kind of stuff can be happening at the DNA level. That's what makes it awesome. All right. Okay, a little cell anatomy and physiology, not probably very much more than you learned in like grade 10 biology, but that was in grade 10. That was a little bit of a little refresher. Axons and dendrites, as we can see here on this deformed moose diagram. I think that'll be the album art for the iTunes version of the podcast. Let's just take a picture. Increase the surface area. There we go. Nice. Let me get a picture of all you guys, too. You guys want to be on the internet? I won't put that up. I'd have to get all of you to sign release forms. I'm just not doing that, sorry. They, of course, increase the surface area of the neuron greatly. Probably the majority of the surface area is axon. And you'll see some of these pictures of some of these different kinds of neurons. They don't look anything like my moose, but they don't even look anything like the nice diagram we had at the beginning. Dendrites are even bigger than we... It's not worded very well. Dendrites are made a whole lot bigger by dendritic spines. So, as you can see with my moose here, these things will extend out and out and out and branch off and off and off. Okay? You only got one axon per neurotransmitter, or per neurotransmitter, per neuron. One axon. This starts with the axon hillock, which of course is where, well, the axon hillock is where the axon starts. It's where it breaks off from the nucleus. Yep. That's the axon hillock. Hillock is a word that means hill. But I guess they couldn't call it the axon hill because they thought it would sound better if they said hillock. It's Hank Hill's long-lost brother, Axon Hill. Depending on, and we saw this in the original, the nice diagram, the end of the axon might not just end like the nose of my freak moose. You may have a whole lot of different other ends too, which are called teleodendria, like little spines. And if I'm not mistaken, that means touching the dendrite in teleo. That's probably Greek, but I'm not sure. Pretty sure it means touch it, you know, it means tickling the dendrites, gently massaging them. Teleodendria. It's like the name of some character in a play, right? And then Teleodendrium went into the arena to fight Axon. I'm in a rare mood today, I don't know why. Hey, I'm missing Friday. I missed you guys so much. And I think that's what it is. And it's seeing your smiling faces. Well, sensing them. I can't really see them. All right. Cells have parts. Okay, at the end, there's a terminal button. A lot of people call that the bouton, which is funny. It's always seemed to me like that spells button. I don't know. This connects with the next dendrite. There is a gap, of course. That gap is the synapse. And we'll talk all about synapses. We'll spend like two classes on synapses, probably. Information basically travels down the dendrite through the axon to the next dendrite, and so on and so on and so on. And that's very general. Okay, it's not necessarily the case that it's always axon to dendrite. That's the one we all learned about in intro, and that's probably the most common type of synapse, and it's only one of seven different kinds of synapses, okay? Did I say Slevin? Just watch that lucky number Slevin. I think I said Slevin, not seven. That was awesome. Oh, it's a little violent at times. And I figured it out halfway through. It was still awesome. Awesome movie. So I checked that out. I'm not going to spoil it and tell you how it ends. But it's awesome. I'm going to watch it again and count how many people get killed. Because it's lots. But it's a really good movie. It's like that film noir. It's like coming back, right? I think it's awesome. All right, here's different types of neurons. These are taken from the book, actually. Okay. We got a bipolar neuron, which has a short... here we have one here. Okay, a short dendrite and a short axon. This looks like the classic neuron, doesn't it? This looks like the ones you saw in your intro book. It's got a ball, and that's the cell body. It's got a thing at the bottom, and that's the axon. And a thing at the top, that's the dendrite. And then there's all the other kinds. But that's a bipolar neuron. Then we have a lot of sensory neurons. These are all, it's a type of sensory neuron. Has a lot more connections. So we can have a somatosensory neuron here. Okay, and that's going to be to skin or to muscle, to sense where something is or pressure, things like that. Look at this. See, it's a lot longer, right? A lot more dendrite, and really a lot more axon, too. Then we have interneurons. That's what these are. These are the ones, and it's going to make sense here. We're going to have even more connections, because interneurons are the things that are between sensory and motor. Indeed, the most of the neurons we have are interneurons, aren't they? Right. We have an association cell. That's called that because the notion is that that's where things are put together. A lot of connections. So an association neuron is right here. Look at the dendrite. It's like all dendrite. Also sometimes called a stellate cell because it's kind of like a star because it sort of goes out like that. So it's kind of like a star. Then we have a pyramidal cell. That's called that because it's got a vague sort of pyramid shape. I think they should have called it a Christmas tree neuron because it looks more like a Christmas tree to me. But you can see here we have a little bit of dendrite. Look at the Purkinje cell. Wow. Little tiny cell body. Nice axon hole here. And then like dendrite. It's like Dendrite City. It's like a rainforest. If a rainforest was like a neuron, it's a really weak analogy. These tend to be integrating sensory information, things like that. But you can see, if these are going to be interneurons, we're going to want a lot of connections. This is what we're doing when we're analyzing information and getting ready to send signals out to do behaviors and to think, in essence. There should be a lot of space for connections. Whereas like a sensory neuron, the top two there, there's going to be very little. It should be like input. But this is now, basically in a lot of respects, this is like the motherboard of your brain if you're into computers. Top part's the keyboard. All you need is like one place to put stuff in, right? And then we have motor neurons. And you can see, again, pretty simple. We've got a lot of places to get connections. So a decision can be made to say, make a muscle move. But really, the axon comes out nicely, pretty simple. Not nearly as crazy with the dendrites as, say, a Purkinje cell or a stellate cell. Pretty straightforward. All right, questions so far? I don't trust this thing. So you get a synapses onto a muscle, basically. So now we know about two kinds of synapses, don't we? We got axon dendrite, the sort of standard thing. And then at some point, you have to have axon to muscle, don't you? Because something has to be releasing neurotransmitters onto my muscles to make them move, to make them contract. And we'll learn about five others. Okay, so you get these different kinds of neurons. Pretty recent discovery is the synapse. Sherrington sort of figured it out earlier, made an amazing discovery, figuring out that he knew the speed of nervous transmission, sent a little bit of electricity to a dog's spinal column, and the leg moved. He knew how long the neural fiber was. And it's like, it took too long. There must be a gap between the neurons, which is very clever. I mean, that's a pretty neat piece of deductive reasoning, isn't it? But to actually see them is pretty recent, because we had to have very powerful electron microscopes to see synapses. But now you can see them. And there are these gaps between axons and dendrites. Chemical messages, or messengers, if you will, are sent across the gap, across the synapse, from one neuron to the next, or from one neuron to a muscle. These are neurotransmitters. There are many neurotransmitters, and we will learn all about many neurotransmitters when we have the lectures about neurochemistry. Now, there's a lot of feedback. So one, you tend to think that axon releasing neurotransmitter to next dendrite is a one-way street. But it's not. You get the flow of information, in a lot of respects, comes back and forth chemically. You get enzymes released, etc. You also have feedback loops where you can have a cell that doesn't actually synapse onto itself, but it's part of a circuit. So you can get sort of feedback. You get excitation and inhibition. This is actually a relatively complex calculation that a neuron's doing. Because the neuron has to decide. Now, I know this is not like a little neuron guy thinking, okay? When we talk about a neuron making a decision, it's either fire or don't. That's all we're talking about here. We're not talking about anything more complicated than that. But what we have here is the neuron is constant. It's like it's getting votes to fire or not. Okay? Now, what we would have would be, and I'll just do this sort of stylistically instead of drawing my bad neurons. We got a neuron here, and it's going to make a decision to fire or not, okay? And then we got a neuron here, and a neuron here, and one here, and one here, and one here. And these are all connected into this. Right? Okay? So, this guy says go, this guy says go, but these guys all say don't go. It's almost like a vote. How much is there enough? Was there enough yes votes to fire? The no votes might be sending no information at all, or it might be actually sending, say, something like GABA as a neurotransmitter, which is an inhibitory neurotransmitter, making it less likely the neuron will fire. So they can either be sending a don't fire or a no vote. They can be abstaining or they can be voting against. Now, this isn't only happening in time, because you would think this would be happening all at once, like, you know, like when we vote. We vote during a day, and that's it. You vote, you can't go to vote the next day. You can't go, what do you mean, Harper won? I'm going to go vote. You can't do that the day after. Or what do you mean, you know, whoever won? I just picked because he's the prime minister. Getting political. We can get political some other time. Buy me drinks. I'll get very political. I'll do anything for alcohol, actually. So, but that's all in time. It's also going to be true in space. So it might be the case, in fact, that those two on the right, because they're together and synapsing very closely to the same place, it might be that's enough to make the thing fire. So it's not only in time. It's in space where the vote is taken. Okay? And it's more complicated than that. We will get into it. But in essence, it's like that. It's like, if you ever watch, now when I was a kid, we used to always watch some rocket launches on TV, because it didn't happen all the time. And they were doing, instead of going up to a space station floating around, they were going to like the freaking moon. So that was cool. So you watch that on TV. And everybody got to know everything that happened at NASA, right? It was always. And you'd always see these guys sitting in front of these giant computer screens that had like a K of memory. and they all got smokes going, which is great. It's great for the electronics too. But you always hear at the beginning of a launch, if next time you watch a space shuttle launch, right, if you do, it's like still exciting. It's brave people going into space. That's cool. I'd go tomorrow. If they could say, you want to go to space, Dave, I'd say, yeah. Duh. I want a tent named after me downtown. So what they'll do is they ask a bunch of heads of departments, go or no go, right? And some of them are critical enough that their vote means we don't go. Others, it's like, you know, some systems aren't nearly as, now they've probably changed that quite a bit because they have this tendency lately to explode. But it used to be they were a little more, of course they used to all be test pilots and military people too, so it's a little bit different. But it used to be, you know, so big deal, one little light won't blink. That's fine, it can still go. But if it's like, is there enough air? No. Okay, we don't go. But you'll hear that, and they'll say, you know, whatever, whatever, and you'll always hear go or no go. And they don't go. So this is what these are. These are go or no go votes. And it might be the case that there might even be enough neurotransmitter released by one guy here, just one, to make it go. So it's happening in time and in space. So if these two votes don't happen quickly enough, the two yes votes, the two go votes with the neuron, it doesn't fire, perhaps. Okay, it depends on the neuron. It could also be the case that we could have all of these, we could have a whole bunch, like a lot more of these, as I said, but these are very close, and they could all be right beside each other, and there's a big flood of neurotransmitter that makes them go. All right? So there's a temporal and a spatial window. Temporal window just means over time, a certain number of votes within a given time to make the neuron fire. There's also got to be a certain number of votes in a given area. Okay, does that make some sense? I got to reminisce about watching space launches when I was a kid. It was awesome.
Did you see the Christopher McCullough on Blog?
Yeah, I did. That was horrible. Yeah, I remember I was on my way to class. I was on my way to my, which one was that? I was on my way to Psychology 251, Personality, 230 class at Western. Yeah, and my friend Diane, who I was walking to class with, she said, "What's that?" And, you know, I said, space shuttle's going up. Nothing. Of course, it explodes. And, of course, there was the one that come back, you know. The moon was great, though. They went to the freaking moon. They're on another world. They're not just floating around. I'm not saying it's not cool to be in space. But it was the moon! We were fighting the Russians to get to the moon, trying to beat the Russians to the moon. That was cool. Now we're all friends with the Russians, building a big space station. No fun anymore. There's no competition in it. The Chinese are going to the moon, apparently, though. So maybe we can, you know, go to the moon again just to beat the Chinese. You know? Just something to get us excited again. Here's some glial cells. Okay. This is an ependymal cell. It's small and it's oval. It's ovoid, so it's kind of oval. That's what that means. Be like if it was... It's like being Kennedy-esque. That was just for me. And it basically secretes CSF. This stuff makes, these guys make CSF. So you can see we got support functions. That's what glial cells are doing. Got an astrocyte here. Oh, look, astrocyte. Astro, star. Nice. It's symmetrical. It does nutrition and support. Feeding the neurons. Right? Pretty cool. Microglial, they're small, micro, hence the names here are great, actually. Basically, fights off negative things, infection. Not negative things. Yeah, like negative energy, man. In your brain, dude. No, it's basically fighting off foreign objects, things like that. Dead neurons, cleaning up, you know, stuff that doesn't belong. This is one of those words that I've never heard said, and I've read it 1,000 times, and I think I say it differently every single time. Oligodendroglial. It makes myelin around axons. They couldn't have called it a myelin maker, could they? No. In the brain, the spinal column. Schwann cells. See, that's an easy one. It's a guy's name. Schwann. Didn't they make the bikes? That's Schwinn. Why couldn't they call this one, like, it's probably because it was Smith who invented, who discovered them. So they couldn't call it the Smith cell. But Schwann, that's a cool name. Anyway, they basically do the same thing. These guys do it in CNS. These guys do it in PNS. They make myelin. They make that white fatty stuff that is the myelin sheath, you know? So you got white matter and gray matter. They make the stuff that makes it white. Both of them. Ole Grunder Flingenfargen Mugen does it in the CNS, and the Schwann does it in the PNS.
Okay.
Yep. They're basically doing the same thing. So you can see the importance here. We got these guys are doing support functions. This is what they do. And you can see that without these cells, the neurons would die. Questions about glial cells? Yeah, pretty straightforward. It's hard to have questions about just straightforward fact, isn't it? I know. Well, basically, they do repair. If you get a deep cut, you ever had a cut so deep that you got paralyzed? I got part of my thumb that I sliced off with a cleaver. And it's all flat. And it's almost, this is about 15, 18 years later, and now I think the feeling's probably mostly back in it. I was making spaghetti sauce. And I sliced part of my finger off with a cleaver, my thumb off. And I had no Band-Aids. So I ran to the neighbors and said, "Even a Band-Aid, I've cut part of my hand off." You ever get a deep cut like that, though? You get paralysis. You can't feel anything. You can't move part. Like, it's really bad, right? So in this case, we can repair these. Now, that's not in your spinal column or your brain. But, you know, there's going to be, of course, there's clearly neurons here. I can feel my finger touching my hand. So the old axon dies because it's been cut. What makes you think I won't cut you? I love saying that. You know, it's awesome. So what happens is microglia and Schwann cells go into the pathway and sort of clear away for the next axon. The microglia comes in and cleans it out. I talked about that, right? How what they do is they clean out dead bits. So they'll come in and they'll just like, okay, let's get rid of this, let's get rid of this. And then the Schwann cell comes in and sort of makes a tube that it can grow down the new neuron. That's cool, eh? Isn't that neat? And eventually, usually, the feeling comes back, doesn't it? Not always, though. If it's a nasty enough cut, it won't all come back necessarily. But I mean, like, the part of my thumb is still flat, first of all, and also it's still a little bit numb. Not nearly as numb as it was, say, 5 years ago, though, where you could, like, light my thumb on fire and be like, "Come on, baby, light my thumb on fire." And nothing would happen. It would be just, I didn't even notice. All right. And what happens is the neuron, let's say the axon gets lopped off. Axon's dead, neuron's still alive. Neuron starts sprouting off like a little seed, little sort of reconnaissance missions, sending out like little spikes until it's like, oh, found the pathway, and grows through, right through there. Awesome. Very awesome. And you may ask, then why doesn't it do that in the central nervous system? Well, it's totally inhibited in the central nervous system. And I think I mentioned this the other day. Attempts have been made to get these little, little tiny tubes, synthetic tubes have been put in to see if they can get neurons to grow. And they also have to, there's a lot of other things that has to have to happen. You also have to know where to put the freaking tube. I mean, that's not the easiest thing in the world. And on that kind of depressing note, we'll end for today, and I'll see you Friday unless I have another flat tire. Thanks, everyone.
Asking the clouds up in the sky to cover the sun when it's too bright. I hear the waves sailing for the sand, using the moon for a flashlight. Asking the clouds up in the sky to cover the sun when it's too bright. I need you to know.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share-alike 2.0 Canada. You are free to redistribute and use the information in the podcast as you see fit, as long as you give me attribution. So basically, copyright 2006, David Brodbeck, some rights reserved. The feed is feeds.feedburner.com/Dave_psych. The music that you hear usually in the podcast very often comes from either local bands in the Sault Ste. Marie region, or from www.garageband.com, or from the PodSafe Music Network. Feel free to contact me at dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca for any information on the bands. Or check out the course blog at people.auc.ca/Brodbeck/blog. There is no www at the beginning for reasons that escape me. As well, feel free to join the Frapper Map. There's a link on the course blog, and also on my
main website, people.auc.ca/Brodbeck. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and I'll see you next time.